Time magazine says it's the worst reality TV show ever. So how will Channel 9 handle the ethics of its new program that includes pitting the homeless against the disabled? Hello, I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. The Australian version of The Briefcase hasn't gone to air yet, but judging by its US counterpart, it could enrage.
People will want to watch the public humiliation, the shaming that comes from that, and to be able to discuss it and say, I wouldn't have made that choice.
That's coming up. And why was the Muslim faith of boxer Muhammad Ali significant and divisive in the US civil rights movement? Neither Malcolm Turnbull nor Bill Shorten speak much about their religion, in contrast to Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott, who led their parties to the 2013 election. But religion does inform the values of the current leaders. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll look at the faith lives of the men vying to be Prime Minister after July 2nd. Our guide is writer Roy Williams. His most recent book is Post God Nation, and he's also the author of In God They Trust, The Religious Beliefs of Australia's Prime Ministers. We start with Malcolm Turnbull, who converted to Catholicism, and Roy Williams begins the story.
It appears that Malcolm took the process very seriously. He's spoken and written very eloquently about religious faith. It's unclear from the public record how often he actually attends Mass, and he's been fairly sparing in his sharing with the public his deepest beliefs. In fact, he's on the record as saying he regards religion as, quote, very much a mystery. When you read the occasional piece where he refers to religion, they're extremely thoughtful and show deep knowledge. It's the living part of the faith that I can't quite get a handle on at this point, particularly if you look at his public policy.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a moment because you dealt with that in a recent article for the Melbourne Anglican newspaper. He does seem to defy the stereotype, and I acknowledge it's a stereotype, of the convert to Catholicism. We think of the convert to Catholicism as the one who takes to every doctrine and every practice with a fervour. They love the Latin Mass. They've memorised the Catechism.
It's not John Henry Newman, no.
No, no. And they're quite socially conservative, which Turnbull isn't.
No, he's not. I made the point in that article for the Melbourne Anglican that he's a social liberal, and his views on so-called social issues are simply at variance with the Vatican's. Similarly, and this is a reflection of who he is, a businessman, he openly admits that he's an economic neoliberal. And like it or not, and I hope serious Catholics won't take offence at this, but his positions are really more or less the opposite of the Vatican's on everything. Putting aside the absolute core theological issues, I'm talking here about the secondary public policy issues. But if you compared, say, Malcolm Turnbull and Pope Francis, there's not a lot of common ground there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Frankly, much of his stated philosophy is hard to reconcile with the social and moral teachings of the Church.
Well, it is, because the Church is far more conservative than him on the social issues, marriage, all on that whole raft of questions. And the Church is more progressive than him on questions of economic justice, climate change, and so forth.
Yeah.
The old Malcolm was closer to Pope Francis on climate change, but not the new.
Now, Malcolm Turnbull, as you say, was a convert.
Yes.
What was the religion of his childhood and his youth?
He was a Presbyterian. A nominal Presbyterian, at least, through his father, Bruce. Indeed, Turnbull rather proudly traces his heritage right back to the very early 19th century. A distant ancestor of his, John Turnbull, was one of the original Presbyterian free settlers in Australia, who set up what is still the oldest church in Australia, the Ebenezer Church at Portland Head on the Hawkesbury River. But he admits himself it wasn't a particularly religious boyhood, and he lapsed into agnosticism sort of by his teens.
It didn't stop him having an Anglican wedding, though, did it, in his early 20s? How did that come about?
He was in England at the time, in Oxford, and he wanted to marry Lucy, and she, of course, was Catholic. He Presbyterian, but they married in the Church of England, and Malcolm apparently used his powers of persuasion on the local priest to say, you owe a duty as the head of the established church to prevent fornication in your parish. They were his exact words, apparently.
Yes, he seems very proud of the sort of legalistic game he played with the local Anglican vicar. What prompted Turnbull's conversion to Catholicism. It appeared to happen as the entire Turnbull family itself was, I guess, re-examining their faith, according to your piece.
Yes, you've got to go back a couple of steps here. Malcolm Turnbull's father-in-law, Tom Hughes, raised a Catholic, but he fell away, as I understand it, for some time, but then was brought back to serious Catholicism by a Jesuit priest, Emmett Costello, the same man who was one of Tony Abbott's mentors.
And we should say, by the way, a very establishment kind of Jesuit, not quite the Jesuit of the slums that we think about. I think he used to get around in a family Rolls Royce, didn't he?
I've read that too. Yes, indeed. But anyway, there's no question that that Tom Hughes was brought back to serious Catholicism. Lucy then started, and again, I haven't interviewed them, so I really don't want to talk as I'm speaking from a one-on-one discussion, but they are on the record on these subjects. And Lucy, who'd had some sort of epiphanous negative religious experience as a teenager while at school, began going again at St. Mary's Cathedral, I believe it was, and then Malcolm decided that he too would convert.
Yes, it's important to point out that, as you say, while you haven't interviewed Malcolm Turnbull, we're not just speculating idly. This is all from statements that the Turnbulls have put on the record.
Yes.
Another statement that was on the record comes from the former Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, Peter Jensen. He had a pretty stringent view of Malcolm Turnbull and his understanding of Christianity. What did Peter Jensen say?
This was in Peter Jensen's book, The Future of Jesus, which came out, I think, in 2008 or 2009. Some views of Turnbull's were quoted, not on purely theological matters, but on social questions. Turnbull had stated the classic libertarian arguments for free markets on the economic side and individual choice on the question of, you know, what the average citizen should or should not be allowed to do. Jensen said, in effect, I think Jesus would disagree on everything that Malcolm Turnbull has said. It was a pretty tough statement. I have to stress again, he wasn't talking about the absolute fundamentals of Christianity. He was talking about the secondary issues of how one should live, and in public policy terms.
Yes, I mean, he was effectively challenging, if you like, Malcolm Turnbull's applied Christianity.
Correct, his applied Christianity in the public sphere.
What do you believe is Turnbull's understanding of his duty as a Christian in public life? He's quiet about it. All of our religious leaders are quiet about it today, compared with, I think we had a discussion at the last election, compared with Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd. But what do you, from what his said publicly, what do you believe Turnbull's view of his Christian duty is?
He said fairly little about this, but reading between the lines, Malcolm Turnbull, perhaps if he was given free rein by his party, and he hasn't been, that's just the truth of the matter, that's the obvious truth. There's no point anyone denying it. If he was given free rein, my sense is he's a man of a bit of the old-fashioned noblesse oblige sort of Christianity. So he's very wealthy. He's largely self-made. The record shows he's been very generous in his own personal charitable giving and so forth, and he and Lucy have been very actively involved in many worthy causes. But the modern Liberal Party, in economic terms, is a neoliberal party, and Turnbull seems to believe in that. Lower and lower taxes, lower and lower social spending. That's just the modern Liberal Party. And if you want to be the leader of it, that's what you have to argue for. My personal theory is that Tony Abbott's failure, at the end of the day, his failure was not for all the reasons normally cited. It's because he was an inadequate spokesman for neoliberalism. Mm. And I actually further think he didn't really believe in it, coming from his traditional Catholic formation, but it's another issue.
But from what you were saying, though, Roy, were Malcolm Turnbull to be, you know, given the freedom to be himself, he would in fact be what Peter Jensen says, and that is more libertarian on economics and more libertarian on social positions. So he would in fact be even further from traditional Catholic teaching.
Yes, I mean, I think that's probably right. The only thing I'd add, though, is that he has said in his public statements that he does want Australia to stay as a higher wage country. In other words, is so wealthy. It's trickle down, but a generous trickle down. Mm. He really believes in the market. He honestly believes in it, I think. Mm. That's the impression I get. And he thinks that's the best way to help everyone, that the very rich will somehow, by some mysterious process, help all. And if everyone was as generous as him, that might be so. But of course, history proves it's not so.
Roy Williams, author of In God They Trust, The Religious Beliefs of Australia's Prime Ministers. And next week, Roy examines the faith of opposition leader Bill Shorten. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. The worst reality TV show ever. I'm quoting directly there from a headline in Time magazine about the program The Briefcase. The program was cancelled after one season in the United States after critics, and not just Time magazine, called it repulsive and cynical. Channel 9 has made a local version in which the needs of the homeless, the disabled, the injured, and the chronically ill are set against each other. It raises major ethical questions, as Dr. Alex Wake, senior lecturer in media at RMIT University, explains.
They're basically giving the contestants $100,000 in cash and saying to two different families, both of whom really need the money for various reasons, you can either have this money or keep a little bit or give it to the other family. And over the course of the program, they learn a little bit more about each other and about why their story and why they are worthy to be given this money. The difference between the American version and the Australian version is that the Australian version is setting itself up as a more of a moral tale. Is it better to give than to receive? In the American version, which was quite controversial, they didn't do it in the same kind of manner and they sort of, you know, let the families battle it out. This one is very much trying to explore that idea of, you know, giving and receiving.
In both cases, however, there does appear to be a gladiatorial element. In the Australian version, you've got a woman with very severe physical disability and her family is being pitted against a family that lost everything in a bushfire. We're talking here about both families who are really struggling.
Absolutely. And that's what so-called reality TV is all about. It's about trying to heighten those ideas. They're trying to say these are both struggling people who need this assistance. They don't want too much grey in there because it's easier when you have a battle to see it in black and white. And this is where the audience comes in to say, I would choose that person or I would choose that family, you know, and get a ratings winner out of it.
Yeah, what seems to make this really ethically problematic is, I mean, let's face it, the amount of money that's on offer here, $100,000, it's not a handsome amount with which you have a lot left over to spare, you know, once you've solved your own family's very real problems. People with real need here, aren't they, are being asked to make a sacrifice.
Absolutely. I don't want to downplay how much $100,000 is to a family that has nothing. That is a lot of money for someone who can't find $2 to give to the tuck shop or can't afford new socks or the school excursion. But to put people in this one against each other, I'm not sure how much you can do to prepare someone for being framed in a way by the media as the good guy or the bad guy. I know in reality television they have a lot of clinical psychologists who work behind the scenes and work with the families and try to help them deal with the infamy or fame that can come with being on one of these programs. But if you're desperate enough to show your life warts and all, you're probably not thinking about the impact of a program like this, not on your life right now, because right now, you know, you just want to get your kid to school or you just want to be able to, you know, pay the next bill. But 5 years down the track, when you're remembered as you're the family from Sylvania Waters or you're that guy who behaved badly on Big Brother, you're not thinking in those kinds of terms. You're thinking more about the immediate situation of surviving.
Yeah, I take your point, Alex, that $100,000 is not an amount of money to be sniffed at. I guess my only point is that these programs don't make the same challenge to people with $10 million. They don't ask people with $10 million to be truly sacrificial, because for the person with $10 million, giving away $5 million still leaves them very wealthy.
Oh, absolutely. And the whole point is that we don't see reality television programs about wealthy people because, frankly, they would never agree to it. They wouldn't put their lives under scrutiny in the same kind of manner because they have other alternatives and other ways of getting money. Yeah. It's not a sexy story to say, here's life on Easy Street.
Yeah. Time magazine, which described The Briefcase as the worst reality TV show ever, says that those who understandably choose the self-preservation option, that is, to either rebuild your family's destroyed home or to undertake some life-changing surgery, if they choose that self-preservation option, they're effectively made to think of themselves as greedy.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the producers will be probably wanting the audience to be arguing about because therein the ratings go up. The more people tune in and can argue about those kinds of decisions. I mean, and even the fact that we're talking about it now shows that the premise of a commercial making show is there. People will want to watch the public humiliation, the shaming that comes from that, and to be able to discuss it and say, I wouldn't have made that choice. Yeah.
Why do people make these choices to appear on reality television?
I always felt that it was the sort of 15 minutes of fame. People wanted to be there and they really didn't understand what was going to happen to them or what the expectation is. But we're increasingly seeing with reality television that it's people trying to use it for their own purposes. You know, they want to start a business and leverage, you know, their own brand, as you might see, say, through the MasterChef series. Sometimes to launch a presidential campaign, perhaps, as Mr. Trump is showing us. There's a lot of complex reasons that people would sign up for it. And I know that the producers spend a lot of time trying to make sure that they don't cast vulnerable people that are going to go off the rails and cause bad publicity for the programs. But there still are a lot of damaged people out there who sign up for these kinds of shows, you know, those weight loss programs and the body image programs. It makes you wonder why we don't have stronger rules in Australia as they do, say, in the United Kingdom about the production of reality television programs.
Well, let's come back and close, with this controversy over the show, The Briefcase. Do you think Australians will be repelled by this kind of exploitative television, especially considering that many of us can relate to families with complex medical problems? Is this something that Australians may take a more critical view of?
From all I've read about it and heard about it so far, I think Australians are going to love it because we like the underdog, we like the battler.
Yeah, but do we like the underdog being forced to make these terribly unfair choices?
I think that the producers of the Australian version of this program are going to be much more careful than the Americans. And they've hinted that there is a twist. I'm going to be interested to see if everyone walks away with nothing. I have an awful feeling that there, a hopeful feeling that there is actually some better news for all sides in this.
Well, Susie O'Brien, a columnist in the Herald Sun, said these are all hardworking people worthy of good luck. So why not give them all the same amount of money and catalogue how they use it to improve their lives? And she said, well, because there's no drama in that process. And that really is the sort of parasitical element of reality television.
Certainly the clinical psychologists that work on this program saying that's what the audiences want to see. It's a sad reality of commercial television. That is what makes people come back and tune in, week out. That's apparently where we are.
Dr. Alex Wake, Senior Lecturer in Media at RMIT University. And you're with Andrew West on RN, Radio Australia, News Radio, online and your mobile.
This here's the story of Cassius Clay, who changed his name to Muhammad Ali.
Well, boxer Muhammad Ali will be buried in the early hours of Friday morning Australian time in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. It will be a Muslim service, but one addressed by leaders and celebrities, including former US President Bill Clinton and Turkey's President Erdogan. Islam was the anchor of Ali's adult life. He converted in 1964, but it was divisive at the time, even in the African American community. Indiana University religion professor Cooper Harris is writing a book about Ali's faith. I asked him why Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali.
He tells an interesting story about being a child sitting in church, looking around at the paintings of Jesus, and Jesus is white, and the pictures of heaven and the angels are white. He lives, of course, in a segregated community. And so this sets off a kind of dissonance for him. And one of the things that he recognized and loved on his travels when he was an amateur boxer going to Chicago and seeing these young men in their bow ties looking very official, selling Muhammad Speaks, the newspaper of the Nation of Islam. And I think this attracted him. There was a kind of a regimentation to it. And he saw in these young Muslims a way to address the wrongs that he witnessed growing up and the harms that he and his people had suffered.
Yes, he was quoted as saying something like being in Islam gave him a sense of self-esteem that Christianity didn't.
No, that's correct. I mean, for the Nation of Islam in particular, the notion is that Christianity is the white man's religion. It is the religion of slavery. Mm. African Americans became American and became Christian by virtue of being enslaved. Mm. And so the question becomes, why would you want to remain within this religion?
And that also was, I think, the motivation for his abandoning his original name, Cassius Clay. I think he said it was the name of descendants of slaves.
That's true. He was Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr. His father was a senior. And the name actually is for a white Kentuckian, Cassius Marcellus Clay, who was the cousin of Henry Clay, the statesman and slave holder and the great champion of slavery. Now, Cassius Marcellus Clay, the historical figure, was actually an abolitionist. Still, the fact remains, this is a name that was given because of enslavement. This is my white man's name that takes away the name that has been stolen because of enslavement.
And Muhammad Ali joining the Nation of Islam wasn't universally welcomed, of course, by the African-American community, was it? I mean, there was an occasion when at least two of his rival black boxers, Floyd Patterson and Ernie Tyrrell, refused to refer to him as Muhammad Ali, and that really raised his hackles, didn't it?
It did. Floyd Patterson is an interesting case. He was a convert to Catholicism, and so claimed that he was going to win the championship and bring it back to America for Christianity, notoriously refused to call him Ali, would call him Clay. And in fact, the story is that when Ali fought Patterson, he actually strung him along probably longer than he needed to, prodding him, say my name, what's my name, what's my name?
Yes, and there was, I think, that famous footage where he has a brawl almost on television with Ernie Tyrrell. They're slapping each other during an interview, and the legendary Howard Cosell, who became a friend of Muhammad Ali, stands by, he's the sportscaster, and sort of calls the brawl as if it were a fight.
Yes, yes.
Why would Muhammad Ali's conversion to Islam have in fact scared some black Americans as well?
Looking at it through Patterson is one way to think about it. Patterson was a true integrationist. And if you think about the nature of civil rights, the civil rights struggle in the U.S. at the time, you can boil it down, I think, essentially to a couple of factions. One would be what we now recognize as Martin Luther King, which was more about an integrated situation, about creating equality for people to live together. What the Nation of Islam did, and we see this certainly in Malcolm X, they were a separatist group. They believed that the races should live separately, that African Americans should look after themselves. They did not need to find validation from other people. And so part of what we see in these arguments, part of what we see in this religious dispute, is a real struggle over the political nature of civil rights, of citizenship within this really tenuous time in American history.
And Professor Harris, how did Muhammad Ali's conversion to Islam inform his decision to refuse the draft, to refuse to serve in Vietnam, which of course ended up being a very costly decision? He was basically out of professional boxing for something like 4 years, so the sacrifice was considerable.
It's inextricable from the decision. Ali, as a member of the Nation of Islam, understood that there were power structures that existed that sought to subject African Americans, to subject non-whites, He also claimed that this is the case with the poor as well. And essentially what he understood was this kind of oppression at home was similar to the colonial ideal that was being propagated abroad. And so what he says is, I'm not going to go fight against the Viet Cong, because he recognized in this potential enemy something of himself and something of a parallel situation.
And just as we wind up, Professor, he does convert to a more mainstream Sunni Islam in the 1970s, and then even later in life becomes a Sufi Muslim. What informed these decisions to move away from the political nature of the Nation of Islam to an Islam that was more of a pure faith?
The thing with especially his move away from the Nation of Islam in 1975 is that that is when Elijah Muhammad, who is the charismatic leader of the group, dies. There's a power struggle. Ali sides with Elijah Muhammad's son, who turns what was once the nation into a more mainstream or group. It becomes Sunni. He's part of that movement. I also think that what's really interesting about Ali is that he becomes an American Muslim at the very moment that Islam in America is beginning to change. 1964, he converts. In 1965, there is immigration reform that brings in immigrants from throughout the world. Whereas before, immigrants tended to be white or from European countries. Now they were coming from Africa, from Asia. And this brings more Muslims into the country just by virtue of demographics. And so one of the things that Ali is seeing in his travels, one of the things that he's seeing as the face of Islam is changing, is that the Nation of Islam's vision of Muslim identity as Black identity doesn't hold up as well in the face of a more global orientation. Now, there always was kind of a global aspiration in it. But what Ali sees is globalism, and he's responding to it.
Muhammad Ali did use his Islam for almost diplomatic purposes. In fact, he was rather successful in the early 1990s. What happened?
As I understand it, was sent to negotiate the release of hostages with Saddam Hussein around the time of the first Gulf War. He had this charisma. He had this ability to connect with people. And by virtue of being a global figure, an American, a Black man, and a Muslim, he had this ability to connect with an even broader array of people throughout the world. And I think that made him so successful, both as a diplomat, but also as a humanitarian.
Yes, well, he managed to charm Saddam Hussein, I think, into releasing 15 American hostages. Cooper Harris is a professor in the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University. He's at work on the definitive account of Muhammad Ali and his life in the Islamic faith. Professor Harris, thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Catch me if you can. And that is this week's program. You can download and share our stories from our homepage at the RN website. Next week, John McCarthy, just back from the Vatican, where he was Australia's ambassador. He wants to ramp up the campaign against modern slavery. Some very sobering facts there. But thanks this week to producer Nadiet El-Ghouli and technical producer Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.